You're listening to Psych Talk.
This is Psych Talk, and I'm Jose Dras Lopez. Our guest this time is Liz Paxton. She's a storyteller who took a Peace Corps assignment in Morocco and ended up spending 5 years there. She got her MBA at Kenan Flagler in UNC Chapel Hill, and she became an avid couch surfing host when she got out of school. We started by talking about her Peace Corps experience.
When I was in college, I looked at the Peace Corps, and a recruiter came on campus, and I spoke with them, and I said I was interested in doing business work somewhere warm. And I received my assignment a few months later, and it was teaching English in Russia. So that wasn't quite what I had
sort of like
for.
The opposite or
yeah.
Do you think that was a bad listening on their part, or that they thought it was still going to be good for you and they just, that's part of their secret sauce to throw the unexpected at people?
I think it is a little bit part of their secret sauce. With the Peace Corps, you can usually, there's three variables. It's what are you going to do, where are you going to go, and when are you going to go? And I think you can be very specific on one of those three variables. And you could say, I really want to teach English, but I don't care when I go and I don't care where I go. I think that for some college students, sometimes when they come, maybe some recruiters aren't taking into account as much what the person says they want to do. And so I chose to turn down that assignment. And I went to Washington, D.C., and I worked for the Justice Department and antitrust as a paralegal for a few years and got to know the local recruiters well there in D.C. and talked to them more about what I was interested in doing, and ended up getting an assignment doing small business development in Morocco, which is a lot more in line with what I wanted to do. And I accepted that assignment, and it was back in 2002. And I ended up staying there for 5 years, actually.
Cool. What was your experience like starting just with at the airport? Like, what were your feelings as you were first jumping into your assignment?
I was excited. I remember that we were only supposed to have two bags, but I packed three, figuring there'd probably be a guy that only packed one. So, and I brought everything from Tupperware to CDs. I mean, it was a time, I mean, it really was a different time, even though it wasn't that long ago. You know, it's 10 years ago, I guess. And I brought CDs, I brought Tupperware, I brought hiking shoes, I brought just a variety of plethora of things.
Were you given a packing list?
Yeah, they gave us suggestions on what to bring. And I remember being excited, but also being nervous. I really had no idea what Morocco would be like.
Did you study up on the language or prepare yourself for the culture in some way?
Not very much. I spoke French already. I'd been a French major in college, so I spoke French. I didn't speak any Arabic yet. And I just really hadn't had any exposure to people from Morocco. And to be honest, I didn't do a whole lot of research. I was nervous about the Muslim culture for women. I was nervous about that going over.
So you land in Morocco. And how many people are you traveling with at that point?
It was 50.
Wow.
50 volunteers. They call it a stage. It's a French word, and there were 50 of us, and I arrived in a country that had, it's a pretty big country, had 200 volunteers total with us. And there was small business development, English, health, and environmental science. I remember landing, I remember the smells, and the people were just really incredible in Morocco, so welcoming. I remember that. I remember lots of stray cats. Those are my first memories.
I think you're a cat person. I have off-record knowledge that you probably like the stray cats.
Well, I loved cats. It was challenging to see so many cats suffering because when cats are stray, they're not all well-fed and well-taken care of. But I actually adopted two cats when I was in Morocco and brought them back to the U.S. So I have two Moroccan cats. One of them is a very large cat, and there are many vets that have told me he's the largest cat he's ever seen. So
good growth in spite of being a stray.
Yeah, well, I got them young.
Okay, then when they were cute, straight.
But I do remember one funny story with the cats. I had only one at the time, and I was flying from Oujda on the Algerian border to Marrakesh, which is about a 14-hour train ride, opposite ends of the country, and I was going to fly with my cat. And in Morocco, I mean, that's unheard of. You know, there are a lot of people that can't afford to feed themselves, much less a cat. And so we got to the airport with my cat, and it was in kind of a picnic basket, and the guys at the x-ray machine where you put your bag on, they wanted me to put the cat through the x-ray machine. And I was like, Allah, Allah, I'm not doing that.
That's funny. So you just convinced them by saying no?
Yeah, well, they were very jovial. Moroccan people are really amazing. If there's any Moroccans listening, I can't tell you how much affinity I have for the culture, the language, and the people. It was really amazing, and I stayed on past my Peace Corps experience. I stayed on for a total of 5 years. I learned Arabic, and I really integrated into the community there.
So what would you say the balance was of business and pleasure when you first arrived? Was it a lot of official Peace Corps business?
Yeah, well, let's see, business. I mean, it was mostly lessons. We had language lessons. I mean, they give you about 6 months of training total. And sure, there's definitely like these are the rules and this is what you have to do and you are representing your country here. But they put us in host families. I remember for the first 3 weeks, I was with someone else in a host family, another volunteer. And then I went to site-based training, and I was in site-based training for about 2.5 months in a host family on my own, but we were training with 6 other volunteers, and we had language classes 6 days a week. And then I was sent to my site, and it was just me. I was in Tetouan in the northern part of Morocco across the Strait of Gibraltar from Spain. And my job was helping artisans to reach new markets. So potters and weavers, and basket makers and wood carvers and things like that.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not that familiar with all the training and sort of preparation process that the Peace Corps set up. So it sounds like it's pretty well organized.
It was very well organized. It was. The language classes were excellent. And then we also had classes in what we were meant to do. So for us, it was craft. And so we learned about the Moroccan crafts and the crafters, and as well as the government associations that we'd be paired with to work with the artisans. So it was well organized. We weren't incredibly well resourced, though. And we didn't get a lot of direction after that. It was kind of, here you are in your site. Go find artisans and help them. Just challenging.
Right. Okay. Was there any point where you were being paid or you were paying money for any part of the Peace Corps process?
No. So the Peace Corps pays for everything. They pay for your airline ticket over there, and they pay your host families when you're staying in a host family. And then when you're on your own, you get a stipend, and they pay for your apartment, and you have health insurance. So my apartment was about, I think it was about $140 a month. So they paid that, and then they gave me a stipend of $200 a month. And then when you come back from the Peace Corps, you get a sum of money. I think it was about $7,000. It depends on whether you complete your service or not. And that's reintegration money.
So give us a little bit of a sense of Morocco's geography, because you said you started in one place and ended up in Tetouan. So paint a little bit of a picture for us from what you can remember.
Sure.
Of if you were a little red line on a map, where would you be bouncing around?
So Morocco is located in West Africa, Northwest Africa. It's about the size of California, and it's an incredibly varied country. There's the desert, the Sahara Desert. There's the Mediterranean Sea. There's the Atlantic Ocean. There's the Atlas Mountains. There's the Reef Mountains, which are completely different. So it's incredibly varied in its geography as well as its culture. It is a place where I would say at least three cultures come together. There's the African culture from the south, there's the Middle Eastern culture from the east, and then there's the European culture from the north. And in Morocco, Morocco is a former French colony, but the north of Morocco is actually a Spanish colony. And if you've ever watched Casablanca, there's a map and they show Morocco and they show Spanish Morocco and French Morocco. So you have Spanish in the north, you have French, and then you have Moroccan Arabic, which is a dialect of classical Arabic. And the difference is sort of like French and Spanish. They're very different. And then you have 5 recognized Berber dialects, which is the indigenous language. And there were Peace Corps volunteers that only learned Berber and then were not really able to communicate when they went to big cities because they didn't speak Arabic.
Ah, it's tough. Well, I guess it's just as hard to learn all the languages that people know in the area. I guess French is the most universal language?
I would say, although since the French left in 1956, it's becoming less and less, I would say it's becoming less and less prevalent, especially among the poorer populations that aren't necessarily in school. The intelligentsia of Morocco certainly speak French well. But if you're traveling off the beaten path, you're going to have a hard time communicating in French.
Hmm. Well, luckily you knew French and you got language classes for Arabic. Mm-hmm. Did you dabble with Berber at all?
No, I knew a couple of Berber words because I lived in Marrakesh. And you're asking me a little bit about the geography of Morocco other than that, the cities. Tetouan was in the north of Morocco. I lived there for about 6 months. I lived in Oujda all the way on the eastern side on the Algerian border for about 2 years, and I lived in Marrakesh, which was all the way in the south for 2 years. And Marrakesh is the city where the most Berber is spoken in a big city. What happened is that the Romans came, and the Romans were the first ones to come in and colonize Morocco, and Rome set up places for olive oil and wheat and wine. And when they met the indigenous people, they thought that they were barbaric, and they called them barbars, and that became the Berbers. And then about 700 years later, the Moors came through from the Middle East, and they swept up through and came to Spain and swept back through, and brought Islam with them. And those that weren't interested in converting were pushed to less desirable ground. So the Berbers are really spread. They're oftentimes in the mountains or in the desert. And Marrakesh is surrounded by the Atlas Mountains, and it's the only city, I would say, where there's a large Berber population. So when I lived in Marrakesh, to come back to your question, many people asked me if I knew Berber words, and I just knew a few. I knew how to say eat and water.
What do those sound like?
Well, eat was ish, and water was aram. No, I think that was bread, actually. I think aram was bread. Oh, I'm rusty on my Berber. I'm better with my Arabic. Just enough words to make people smile.
You know, I did a summer Arabic camp when I was much younger, like in early high school. And I do remember some focus on different dialects. I think I was told that the Moroccan dialect was one of the most distant from standard Arabic. But it was also fun. It's a fun language. Is hello, salamu alaikum?
Yes, and then the response is wa alaikum salam, which is peace be with you, peace also be with you.
Right. It's asymmetrical, right?
It was very biblical. The language, there were many what we called God phrases, where there was a call and response that was specific. And another thing that was very biblical about being in the country was seeing so many people on donkeys and in robes and seeing so many sheep herders. I didn't expect that. And then the other interesting part was really the juxtaposition of that biblical culture with modern day society, and that they both came together in the same place. It was like two time zones colliding. I remember once walking in a village in Azru outside of Fez and seeing a woman on a donkey with parsley on either side. She was headed to the market and she was speaking loudly. And I turned thinking that she was speaking to me, and she was speaking on a cell phone. And it was such a, you know, an odd sight to see this woman on the donkey with the parsley and the cell phone. And she probably didn't have running water in her house, but she had a cell phone. And wow. And there were times where you'd see a big fancy Mercedes-Benz stopped at a stoplight and a donkey with a cart of oranges crossing. And so it was like really a place where both those worlds came together.
I'm wondering what your amenities were. Where were you on that divide of technology and opulence versus living the biblical simple life?
Yeah, I think I thought before I went to Morocco that I would live a more rural lifestyle than I did live. And there were many volunteers that had more rural lifestyles, especially volunteers that were in health environment. In the business setting, the business volunteers, the years I was there, were in larger cities. And so I actually had a pretty nice apartment. Everything was tiled. I didn't have heat in the apartment. That was tough, so no heat. And tile floors and cement buildings, so it gets cold. I had a refrigerator. I had to buy my own refrigerator. That was tricky. In fact, sidebar story, I remember one day I was really waiting. I was trying not to buy a refrigerator. So I'd buy food and it would last a couple of days and I'd eat it. And at one time I'd finally gotten so sick of it and I'd made up my mind to buy a refrigerator, and I was walking and I ran into my landlord and he said, Aziza, because that was my Moroccan name. Aziza, do you need a refrigerator? And I was like, yes, I need a refrigerator. And he said, I have one for you. And it was, if you've ever been to the supermarket and you've seen those drink refrigerators at the end of the aisle that have the drinks in them, so they have the clear front.
Yeah.
It was Coca-Cola. It was a Coca-Cola refrigerator with a clear front. So I always knew what was in their fridge, as did anyone else in my kitchen.
Hey, that's useful. They should make more see-through refrigerators.
So I had a see-through refrigerator. I had a gas. I had a gas heater. Heater for warm water. I had a cell phone, but it was always running out of minutes. You bought minutes with cards and you're always waiting for the specials. I traveled with a laptop, so I had a laptop, but I didn't have internet in my apartment.
These days, that would be intolerable.
Right. I'm sure the volunteers now have it. It was pretty expensive then. I washed my clothes by hand until I met people that had washing machines that I was able to use. So that was my side of the opulence versus non-opulence.
Mm-hmm. What city would you say you spent the most time living in?
I spent the most time in Oujda and Marrakesh. Marrakesh was 2 years, and Oujda was about a year and a half, almost 2 years, though. So most of the time in those two cities, which couldn't have been more different. Oujda was in the middle of the desert. It was really poor city. It was a large city, 700,000 people, but it was a very poor city. Marrakesh was a tourist capital, 3 million people, I believe, when I was there. A lot of expats. Oujda was really off the beaten path. In fact, I remember once I was watching a movie. I was in Rabat, the capital, and I was watching a movie, and it was a kind of a cheesy Moroccan crime movie. And the good guy had upset his boss, who was a bad guy, and he was being sent away. And so he called his fiance and he said, "Honey, I'm being sent away." And she said, "Where are you being sent?" And he said, "Oujda." And then the music was like, dun, dun, dun. And I was like, wait, I live there. I live in that horrible place that you're saying it was like the Siberia of Morocco.
Right.
But it was a wonderful place. People were very loving and kind and warm.
Well, did you notice different types of people in different parts of Morocco?
Mm-hmm.
Like you said that there are different cultural tides meeting in one place, and there are different levels of poverty or economic development. How did you see that reflected in how friendly people were or what perspective they had on the world? Like, I would maybe guess that Oujda was a little more fervently religious than Marrakesh, but I have no idea if that's true.
You know, I think that's an interesting comment. It's hard to really know how religious one is in Morocco because everyone is religious on the surface. So it's hard to know, and they're really not generally comfortable. I only ever had one person tell me that he was atheist. And I mean, 98% of Morocco is Muslim, and if you're born in Morocco, then you're considered Muslim, and you have to follow the rules as a Muslim. I found that the men went to the mosque, and the women. I mean, I found that the culture generally was pretty religious on the outside. In terms of values that I was able to observe, I generally found that the poorer people were more sincere and more honest and better people. And the people that had generally, and I'm really generalizing here, but these were my experiences, the people that had more money became more superficial. And maybe this is true in any culture, really, more superficial. Marrakesh was a tough place because it was a big tourist destination. And as a result, many people were kind of scrambling for the dollars that the tourists represented. And so it was a harder place to be a foreigner because I felt like in Oujda as a foreigner, I wasn't seen as much as dollar signs. But in Marrakesh, it was more so. And I felt it was more of a shark tank in Marrakesh.
Over time, did you find ways to blend in more like a native and not be labeled with dollar signs as a tourist in Marrakesh?
Yeah, I mean, generally, I blended in pretty well. I have a little bit darker skin, I have darker hair, and I spoke Arabic well. And so I was able to blend in pretty well. But there were times where I would have guests and it would be obvious that I was foreign. So yes, I was able to blend in pretty well, but I still wasn't Moroccan, you know. There's still a difference there.
We bounced from religion to talking about Marrakesh. And I'm still curious, especially since at the beginning you said you were worried about the whole Muslim aspect of life and being a woman. Were your fears in line with reality? How did you acclimate over time to that?
Yeah, it was tough being a woman there. I think that it was probably easier being a foreign woman than a Moroccan woman. I was a little bit higher up on the pecking order, I found, and could get away with more things in terms of speaking to men or speaking my mind more publicly. The most challenging thing was the sexual harassment, which was really constant. And it was really mostly catcalls on the street. And that was really hard to deal with because as a Peace Corps volunteer, you don't really have a lot of resources. So you're walking on the street a lot. You're taking a lot of buses. And you just get catcalled all the time. And it wasn't even like anyone was saying anything really mean. It was like, "Hey, baby, hey, beautiful." But it really wears on you over time because it just felt like you were constantly being put down, constantly told that these men could say things to you that you weren't really, you didn't really have any power. And I reacted all different ways. There were times I would try to talk to them. I'd stop and I'd say, why do you say that to me? Or would you say that to your mother or your sister? And they were always shocked. They were shocked that I would stop because it was that behavior for them was completely normal. And they didn't understand why I found it to be aggressive and why I was aggressing them then. And there were times that I would yell, like, and get angry and say, like, obviously you're very badly educated. How dare you? You know, there were times that I would outwardly ignore it, but inwardly it would upset me. I remember one time there was probably about a 13-year-old kid. Maybe he was 15. And he walked past me and he did like some kind of kissy noise and he got kind of close, you know, and he did and he walked and I did that. He walked and I got so angry that I actually, you do that thing where you kick one of their legs and the other leg and they fall forward. You know that thing you can kind of trip somebody from behind?
Okay.
I did that. And he looked at me just like, how could you do that to me? You know, he was shocked that I had done that, but I was just so angry. But really, he was the one acting normally, but I just couldn't handle it that day. There were days that I just couldn't handle it. But I remember my host mother talking to my host mother about it and being so angry about it. And she said, you know, the caravan comes into town and the dogs bark, but the caravan keeps going.
So it sounds like your reaction was so surprising in that culture when what those men expected that they were pretty disarmed by your reaction if you were aggressive. They didn't feel any need to fight back, that they were too surprised.
Well, sometimes, I mean, that kid was definitely surprised. But if there was a group of them and they would fight back, they'd get angry that I was insulting them and they were losing face publicly. And then there were women I talked to about the situation. And some of them said, yeah, they didn't like it. But there were others who said, well, that's how I know if I look pretty one day or not. If I don't get any comments, then I must look really bad that day. So it was kind of interesting to hear that. And I also heard from people who said, well, you know, this is a culture where men and women aren't able to really interact in maybe a more quote-unquote normal or Western way. And this is, if somebody catcalls you on the street, then you know that they might be interested. And maybe then you could tell a friend who can tell that person that you would be interested back. And
some signaling system.
Yeah.
Huh. What was like the most satisfying of those encounters that you had? I guess what would be nice is if someone said, oh, I'm sorry, that wasn't a very nice thing of me to do, right? But probably that didn't happen.
You know, I feel like there were some times that that happened. I think one time that happened and the next day that person who I didn't recognize came up to me and said like, and apologized. Now, I don't know if it was an honest apology or if the Secret Service had made him do that, because we were, you know, this is going to sound kind of paranoid and kind of crazy, but as Peace Corps volunteers, we were in these cities and they were, our country directors as well as the Moroccan police were watching us, wanted to make sure we were okay, but it really bordered on surveillance. And so you would hear, like, my landlord would say, oh, they came by. And I'd be like, who are these people? I never saw them. I never knew who they were. But they were always kind of, like, checking up on you. So who knows? Maybe one of the cops told him he had to apologize
That's
to
funny.
Me or something.
On balance, did that make you feel safer? Sounds a little creepy, too.
It was. It was creepy. No, I didn't like it. It made me angry. I was like, why don't they talk to me? They've talked to – I would go places, and they would say, oh, yeah, they came by. And I'm like, who are these people that came by?
Yeah. Wow. It sounds like out of a movie or something.
That was odd. I don't know if that's true in all countries, but it was true in Morocco.
Yeah. Wow. I'm a mixed blessing. I want to talk about other stuff other than Morocco. So I want to give you a chance if there's a story you really wanted to tell about Morocco.
I'll tell one story. My father came to visit me in Morocco, and he flew into Casablanca, and the train station is right in the airport. And he got on the train, and he was pretty jet-lagged. And we were in kind of a booth, and it was me and my father, and there was a man from Tunisia who was speaking classical Arabic, and there was a Moroccan man who was speaking Moroccan Arabic, and there was a French woman speaking French. And lots of different languages and translations going on in this little booth. And it was an interesting train ride. It was about a four-hour train ride. And the Moroccan man only knew one phrase in English. And so he got very close to my father and said the only phrase he knew. And they really are, they talk much closer than we do. And he said, what's the matter with you? And my father was just kind of taken aback by that. And I have a Moroccan name. It's Aziza. And there were many Moroccans that only knew me by Aziza. They had trouble pronouncing Liz, and I ended up with a Moroccan name. And we were talking about it in the train car, and my father said, well, it would really be impossible probably for you to give me a Moroccan name because I have a very odd name. And they said, well, what's your name? And my father said, well, it's Byron, which, you know, is kind of an odd name.
It is.
And the Moroccan man and the Tunisian man, they put their heads together. I mean, their heads were literally touching, and they put their hands on their chins, and they thought about it. And then in unison, they said, Mohammed.
Sounds very similar.
So that was his Moroccan name.
Nice. Here's the general theme I want to go to. You've been traveling, it seems, when the opportunity has arisen in life, and part of that has been couch surfing. I'm curious about the actual mechanics of couch surfing, like when you meet people, what are they expected to do as your host, and how much is it varied depending on where you've been? So set that up for us.
Sure. So there's a website called couchsurfing.org that allows you to host people and stay with people for free all around the world. And it's something that I discovered later in life. I mean, I discovered it after the Peace Corps and after business school. And I thought it was a nice way for me to give back and to receive travelers and to travel myself. And so I signed up for it. And a lot of people think it's pretty crazy. And they would say, gosh, like here you are at the time, a single woman hosting these travelers. You know nothing about them. You're giving them keys to your house and they're sleeping on your couch. And I was like, yeah, that's about it. But it's a great website because you get reviews, just like on eBay, from your former hosts and people you've hosted, and you put up pictures, and you can get vouched for by people who have a certain amount of status on the site, et cetera. So there are some checks and balances. But I moved to Jacksonville, Florida. I took a job there, corporate America, and I wanted to remain in touch with this community of travelers and dreamers and give me some counterbalance in my life. And I hosted a lot of people. I probably hosted maybe 20 people when I was in Florida, all different people from all walks of life. And I myself stayed. I actually never traveled with couch surfing in Europe, but I did travel around the U.S. At different times. I've stayed, I think, with 5 different hosts in the U.S. In, Asheville I stayed. I stayed in Savannah. I stayed in Seattle. I stayed in Denver and Washington, D.C. Those were the 5.
When you were going as the visitor and being hosted, had you already done quite a bit of couch surfing hosting in Florida?
Yes, I hosted a lot before I traveled. And so I had a fair amount of references. I think that helped. And like I said, I've hosted from all walks of life. I've hosted old people and young people and foreign people and American people and people. There was even one guy who was basically homeless that was traveling around the U.S. and didn't have an apartment anymore and didn't even, you know, just was kind of going from place to place. But he had great reviews and I hosted him and he was a pleasure.
You mentioned that you'd built up some good reputation before you went out to different cities in the U.S. using couch surfing. And it made me wonder if there are ways of sort of gaming the system, to get the best people sooner. Like maybe there's some really stellar hosts that you can only usually get if you like got in lots of great reviews. I don't know if it's actually that complicated.
Well, I think you can. I mean, if you're first joining Couchsurfing and you don't have any experience, I think it's good to find other people that are on there that maybe your friends who have maybe done it that can give you some reviews. And there is a category for just someone who's a friend of yours to review you. So I would recommend that, but it really is a great way to travel and to host. And the expectation is really that you just have a free place to sleep. The expectation is not that you're given keys or that you're given food. That's up to the host or transportation. For me, I only hosted people that I would be comfortable giving keys to. So I did give my host keys to the apartment, and I was gone a lot, so that was important. I worked early and came back late sometimes. I also fed the people, and I enjoyed that. I enjoyed cooking for people and getting to know them. I try to host people that want to stay more than one night, because otherwise it kind of feels like you're just a hotel. And really, I'll tell you, my most memorable couch surfing story was a guy and his son that stayed with me. They're from New Hampshire, and he was married, very happily married, and had 2 kids, an older daughter and a younger son. His son was 11. And his son was having trouble in school and some reading difficulties. And he was afraid that his son was going to fall into the wrong crowd. His son was 11. His son really liked skateboarding. So he made a deal with his son. And he said, I will take you to skateboard in every single state in the U.S. But the deal is that you are going to let me homeschool you for a year. And they He bought a Honda Fit, and he put a big logo that said Skate Kid. And I think they got a blog. They started a blog, and they came and they stayed with me for a week, and it was great. I mean, they homeschooled while I was at work, and I came home and we played games and ate dinner together, and they were just, they were an absolute joy. And they went to the skate parks, and I stayed in touch for a little while. I haven't talked to them recently, but I think they did. They skateboarded in every single state, and they couch surfed all over the U.S.
That's a pretty unique story and a unique arrangement between a father and son. Remind me if you knew what happened to the mom?
You know, she stayed back in New Hampshire. She was a nurse, and so she kept her job in New Hampshire. He quit his job to do this with his son.
Hmm.
And I think they met up for some of the holidays throughout the year.
Did they seem like a very opposite type pair, where like the father was very buttoned down and the son was a punk rebel, or it wasn't anything that extreme?
I don't think it was quite that extreme. I mean, it definitely takes a lot of guts to quit your job and homeschool your kid, I think, and travel all around the U.S. But the father was definitely, the father was seemed fun-loving and interesting, but also definitely expected his son to learn while they were on the trip and had like clear rules in terms of what had to be read and done.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it sounds like it was a memorable, positive experience. And I'm wondering if you had a memorable, like not so great experience.
You know, amazingly enough, I can't really cite a bad experience. The worst experience I had, and they're really not that bad, would be people, there were a couple people that, and one in particular I remember who just stayed for one night, and where it really did feel like I was a hotel. Like they were supposed to get there at maybe 6, and then they didn't get there till 10, and then they left at like 6 in the morning, and they didn't leave me a review, like a nice review afterwards. And so there was nothing wrong with that person, and they were perfectly fine. But that was the worst experience. And I have to say, if that's the worst experience you could have. Now, I think there are people that have probably had bad experiences. And I think if you're not cautious and you let people stay with you that have really no reviews or seem sketchy, I mean, you can have a bad experience too, I'm sure.
Yeah. Dealing with people, there can always be people who are unexpected or rude or who knows what.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay, well, that's really cool. I'll have to try that out. You've almost convinced me just from talking about it.
Yeah, I'll give you a good review.
That's right. Yeah, you just need to have friends to say, hey, this is a nice person. And that's how you get started. That's the trick, right? This is not so much about traveling, but you mentioned that you went to business school. Mm-hmm. And since it was in this area, I think it's topical to mention. We'll probably have someone listening and rebroadcast who's cheering for the heels or just interested to hear about UNC. So why did you end up at UNC, like doing an MBA, and why specifically here?
Yeah, so after 5 years in Morocco in economic development, I was really interested to learn business theory in a classroom. I worked with a lot of people who are like me, came from a liberal arts background and were trying to help countries to improve their businesses. And I didn't think I knew enough about business. I wanted to come back and learn the theory of it. And then I felt that I could attain a higher level in a job and be more impactful. So I looked at two schools. I looked at UNC Chapel Hill. I also looked at Tuck, which is Dartmouth's business school. I looked at those two schools because they were known for having strong leadership programs as well as strong sustainability programs. Came back from Morocco and visited both programs and was really bowled over by the sense of collegiality that existed at UNC. They talk about leadership with heart, and it's really what I found. I found it was a really team environment and a really supportive environment. And I loved Chapel Hill. I still love it. I love being back. It's just a great place.
What do you think about the whole sports aspect of living in town? Like, I moved here not too long ago and would have conversations where someone would mention Tyler Hansborough. I would ask who he is, and I would get the death stare.
I felt like people were more forgiving because I was older, you know, in business school. I went to one of the basketball games, and I just felt like, it is terrible, right? But I felt like, gosh, everyone's just standing up the whole time. I just want to sit down and watch this game. I was like, this isn't fun. So I'll watch this on TV if I'm going to watch it. So I've never really been a sports person. So it didn't bother me too much that this was a sports place, but I didn't feel too pressured to be part of it. But I enjoyed the energy that came with the sports.
Yeah. Makes sense. And there's a nice tribal communal energy.
Yeah.
Which goes back to the teamwork and the heart you mentioned. Well, I'm glad that MBAs can get away with not knowing too much about it. I'm not free yet. I still look too young. I look like I should be a fanboy. Well, okay. So let's wrap this idea of being someone who goes to the Peace Corps and stays in Morocco 5 years. Let's tie that up with someone who got an MBA and went off into the business world. How do you feel you've reconciled like your serious side with your adventurous side? And how do you recommend other people find adventure in life while still planning ahead and just making a stable life for yourself?
Gosh, Jose, that's a really tough one because I definitely feel like a dichotomy. And like as I mentioned, what I did when I first joined corporate America was to still host by couch surfers. And that's how I remained in touch with the traveler. And when I would take vacations, I would still take traveler style vacations and live on a budget and live on a shoestring. And my first 2 years in Jacksonville, I lived in an apartment that didn't have a washing machine. So I was going to the laundromat and interacting with people of different socioeconomic class. And that was important to me and good. I think that it gets harder and harder the more you're in corporate America to continue to be a dreamer and a traveler. And I think it's definitely something that I struggle with. I think that what you have to do if you need to be in corporate America, which I do right now to pay off loans and just establish myself in the business world, that having friends that are in different socioeconomic circles or even just different professions can give you that diversity in life. Volunteering can help with that, reminding you how lucky you are and that not everyone is in the same situation. Traveling can do that. Reading, watching documentary films and liberal films that talk about different lifestyles. I think you have to make an effort because I think as humans, we're poorest people and you are the religion of your friends, you know, whatever water you're steeping in. And so if you only steep in the water of corporate America, and I don't want to put down corporate America, but if you only steep in that water, then that's all you'll have unless you make an effort to do something else. And the same's true if you only steep in any environment, you know. If you're a rock star and you only hang out with rock stars, well, then you're going to have limited perspective as well.
Huh. So it sounds like you're saying a lot of it has to do with people you interact with or people, ideas that you try to reach out toward that are a little more variety than what's just served in front of you.
Yeah, I think you have to seek it out because it won't always seek you out.
Do you feel like you're doing a good job of that so far in your corporate America life?
I feel like I was doing a better job of it earlier in my career. I think it's gotten harder as you move up. The lights get brighter, pressure gets tougher. Definitely we're in a world where we're expected to be connected all the time. And just today, my boss was texting me and calling me about some things. And, you know, it's Saturday. And I'm here at my reunion weekend. So, I mean, that's just... I think that's the reality of it. So I think it has gotten harder. And I think that the number of hours that a lot of us are expected to work makes it harder to have things on the side. But you have to keep pushing for it. I think you always have to step back in life and ask yourself, what are your goals and what do you want to accomplish? And what are the kind of people that you want to interact with?
Yeah. Well, we're not going to solve that problem for everyone.
No.
It's always an issue of balance. But if nothing else, hearing your stories has helped remind us of the value of living a varied life where you meet lots of different people and try new things. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Jose. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest was Liz Paxton. She's sort of an extended member of our Chapel Hill community, now living in California, starting a family, settling down. But it was so great having her on. This is WCOM. Thanks for listening.